Okay, as usual, come on a Friday evening, haven't got much of an idea what I'm going to talk about, but usually come up with something. And it's lovely when you don't plan these things and just let them arise. And you find out if you have the confidence and courage not to plan things, usually life goes on much more smoothly and beautifully. When we plan things, we're just so stiff that we don't adapt to the changing situations, to new ideas, to new ways of doing things. We become sort of so predictable. But when we actually start to just live in the present moment and not make plans and have confidence, then things are much better. They're not perfect. I've been telling people one of my sayings, that I know this from experience, when I don't make plans, then I don't plan the future, then many things go wrong because I don't plan them. But if I do plan, things go wrong anyway. So either way they go wrong, so I might as well enjoy it before it goes wrong by relaxing. That's my motto. Relax before it all goes wrong, because it's going to go wrong whether you plan or not. So you just adapt. But just before I came in, I was looking in my file in the office, and every now and again someone sends a letter, and there was a letter from somebody as a Zen practitioner in Japan, and they were asking a very fundamental, easy question, but I thought I can expand on it for this evening's talk. It's just basically that all this talk in Buddha is about letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, but are we supposed to be doing something as well? Doing something to help people in suffering, such as in Nepal, doing something to help people with cancers, doing something to make this world a more comfortable place, doing something about climate change, or do all this letting go business, isn't that irresponsible? Is it really the best thing just to sit in a monastery and close your eyes to the world and have a wonderful time yourself when everyone else is suffering? Is that the right way to live a life? Or should you go to the other extreme and go out there just running around the place trying to help people and usually making things far, far worse? What should you do in life? Where is a balance between doing stuff, service? Well, this fellow said attachment and letting go. And the first little simile, which I've been telling a lot of people, and especially because it's a friend from India. If you are on the back of a motorbike in India, you must be attached. Do not let go. Otherwise, you'll be dead. There is a time to be attached. And there is a time to let go. And it's wisdom of knowing the difference between those two is actually the reason why people are successful in life. I just came back from teaching a meditation retreat in Thailand. And people were complaining when they were meditating on a retreat. During the retreat time, when they were supposed to be meditating in the hall, they were all falling asleep, getting dull, heads drooping, and even a couple of people snoring. But then when they went to bed at night, after the retreat, you know, the last meditation question and answer was finished, when they went to bed, they couldn't go to sleep. So I told them, it's obvious what you're doing wrong. When you go to bed at night, you should try and meditate. And then you fall asleep. And when you come into the meditation hall, try to fall asleep. And then you'll meditate. Reverse psychology. How many of you do suffer from insomnia? And how many of you, I heard one person snoring, you know, when they were in this meditation today. So look, obviously, that's probably the person who suffers from insomnia. When you're in your bed, pretend you're in Dhammaloka Center meditating with Ajahn Brahm, then you fall fast asleep. Because we don't know how to let go, and it's a time to let go. Sleeping is a time to rest. And we can't rest because we're still attached, holding on, doing stuff. still trying to fix up all the problems which happened earlier today. Someone said something and you didn't say the right answer and you keep saying, I should have said this, I should have done that. Be careful when you think of the past like that. If you did something different, would it be better or would it have been worse? You don't know. That's why I mentioned one of the words which I invented. It's actually not a word I invented, but I changed its meaning. The word ineffable. This is a word in philosophy, in religion. Because they always said, like, God, ultimate truth, the supreme reality. No one can give it a name. You can't describe it. And there's a word for that. It's called ineffable. And to me, that was gobbledygook. What does it mean? If you can't describe it, if you can't convey its essence and meaning to somebody else, it means you don't understand it. But still, it was such a beautifully sounding word, ineffable. I changed its meaning to your past. If I'd have said something else, if I'd have reacted differently, if I'd have done something differently, then the past may have been different. Yeah, sure, it would have been different. Probably much worse. You don't know whether it would have been better or worse. You can't say, you can't predict. Which means the past is ineffable. You can't if your past. If I did something else. If. I can't if the past. I remember I was telling people in Singapore, my first big love affair. My first big love affair, but she dumped me in the end. And oh, if she hadn't have dumped me, what would have happened? I don't know. You can't if the past. Who knows? The pain of getting married might have been even more powerful than the pain of just being dumped. I may become sort of enlightened much quicker. Who knows? Which is, you can't if the past. Well, that's a wonderful thing, which means so often people go back, oh, I shouldn't have done that. If I'd have said something else, if I'd married someone differently, if I hadn't got this job, if I'd have worked harder when I was at school, if. You don't know, it probably would have been worse. Not as good as it is now. Okay, so don't if the past. The past is ineffable. That's a much better meaning of the word, because it actually makes sense and it's useful as well. So don't go to bed at night and thinking, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that. And the other mistake people make, you always think you learn from the past. How many times have people had relationships and they try again and you still don't learn? Why? Because you're learning from the past and there's nothing to be gained there. Don't learn from the past, learn from the present. Now that is a place where wisdom comes from. This is life in action, not a replay. This is where wisdom and truth come from. So, at night time, forget about the past. You can't learn anything from it. And anyway, this is not the time you're supposed to be busy and working. So, there is a button inside of you. It's called the delete button. Delete the past. Press, and the past is gone. That's why I was saying, the secretary, I was in the office, and he thought it was another office worker for the BSWA, because I was shredding paper. I love the shredder. And there's something about shredding documents, you know, which for a monk is just a great delight and pleasure. Okay, there's many pleasures we're not allowed. You know, you can't drink, you can't watch soccer, you can't, so much stuff you can't do, but shredding. The Buddha never made that against the precepts. And it's beautiful. You have this letter which you're supposed to respond to or reply to, you shred it. And, oh, I don't know now. There's a sense of completeness, moving on, moving beyond and being free once you've shredded something. So that's why you see me in the office with these papers and shredding it just for fun. So if any of you got anything you want me to shred, I don't mean your husband or your kids, your mother-in-law. Can you please shred my mother-in-law? Now, you know what I'm talking about. So the same with, when you go to bed at night, the future, you've got to work tomorrow morning, you've got a busy day, you need the rest. If you don't rest and sleep well, how can you perform the next day? How can you enjoy the weekend if you have a sleepless night tonight? It is a simple thing. Now, when it gets to letting go, when you're at bed at night, please let go. That is not the time to attach to the motorbike. That's the time to let it all go. And I told people, just a little simile, because sometimes doing things in your head is not enough. You have to do it physically sometimes. And so, a little thing. If you wear slippers in the bedroom or in the house, before you go to bed, you take your slippers off and put them under the bed. I hope you don't go to bed with your slippers on. That's disgusting. But you take your slippers off. And as you take your left slipper off, a little training, a little practice, a ceremony, a ritual. When you take the left shoe off, or the left slipper, put it under the bed, that's the past. Identify your left slipper with the past. So when you take that slipper off, you're putting all your past under the bed. And then you take your right slipper off, and you identify that with being your future. All the things you're worried and concerned about tomorrow, put that under the bed too. And so when you actually go into your bed, you've left the past and the future underneath the bed. It just helps. You've made that little sort of exercise. It helps so you go to bed, you can let go of things. But when you wake up in the morning, that is not the time to let go. And it's time to get up and go to work. And Ajahn Brahm said, okay, let go. Then you get sacked. Yeah, we'll never get any donations. You won't have enough money to afford the greatest Buddhist conference. Which those tickets are not that expensive. Because, I mean, you can't take any money with you when you die. So I was, okay, it's a long time since I told a stupid joke. Here's a stupid joke for this evening. It's been a long time since I said this joke. A lawyer, this really wealthy lawyer, you know, thought he was smart. He made a lot of money. And when he got very sick and the doctor said he only had a few weeks to live, he thought, how can I take it with me? Just because other people say you can't take it with you, I'm a lawyer, I can find loopholes. So I can take it with you. So he's looking for the loophole so he could take it with him afterwards. He worked so hard to get all that money. And so laying in bed having nothing else to do but think, he had this brilliant idea. He told his wife, he said, go to the bank with my two suitcases, which I usually go overseas with, big suitcases. Go to the bank and draw out as much money as you can from my bank account in cash. I think the biggest note is euro note, isn't it? 1,000 euro note? In 1,000 euro notes. So I can get as much money in my bags as possible. And once you brought the suitcases back, stashed with millions in cash, put them in the attic just above my bed. Because my plan is, when I die and I go up to heaven, I can grab the bags on my way up and take them with me. That's my plan. So the wife, now it's a waste of time arguing with husbands, especially if he's a lawyer. A waste of time. So she said, okay, I'll do that. So she went to the bank, got all the money out and put them in the attic above her husband's bed, just on either side of the bed, so he went straight up, he could actually grab them, not too far to the left, not too far to the right. She got it perfect. And a couple of days later, he died. And after doing the ceremonies for him, she went up to the attic for the first time. And of course the bags were still there, full of cash. I said, stupid old guy. If he'd have asked me, I'd have put the bags in the room below him, because I know where he's gone. Okay, that's a joke for today. So you can't take it with you, not even if you're a lawyer. So you might as well buy beautiful tickets for the greatest Buddhist conference on August the 8th and the 9th. 9th? No, yeah, 8th and 9th. So, anyway. So when you get up in the morning, there is something to do, and give everything you've got. And in life, the whole thing in life is learning how to let go, to relax. Let go of the past and future. Learning how to do nothing so when it's a time to relax, you can. When it's a time to do things, learn how to actually focus and do stuff so when you do things, you can really do it well. There's two parts to life. The time to let go and the time to be attached and do stuff. And a lot of times we get confused. But even more so, when we do know it's a time to let go, like going to sleep at night, we just can't do it. We haven't learned that trick. Because in life, in our education, in Western societies, and Western societies infected all parts of Asia again now, we really know how to work hard. When it's time to do stuff, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. But when the going gets easy, still the tough keep going. That's crazy. It's one of the reasons why many people in the Western world are psychotic, tired, sick with so many diseases, because we forgot the trick, how to relax. And that's what I'm teaching you here every time we meditate, learning how to let go of things. Now, in order to allow yourself to let go, we have to make it important. To market it, to say it's really essential, no matter what you do in your life, to learn how to relax. And of course, there's just so many reasons why you have to relax. If you don't relax now, you're going to die young. Hard workers, people who are like these directors of big companies, and if they work too hard, yeah, they do become rich. They become the richest man in the cemetery. Because they don't know how to just balance their life. The time to relax, we relax. And even during work, lunch hour, even my, where I was brought up was in UK. That had one of the biggest empires in the whole world. In the olden days, because they kept an important tradition. Morning tea break and afternoon tea break. That was the reason, that was the essential cause that they conquered the world. Tea. But there was a lot of, I'm just not joking here, to be able to relax for 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the afternoon, have a proper lunch hour, that meant you were allowing your mind to relax so much that when you went back to work after the tea break, you were fresh, new ideas, you could perform. It's what I call efficiency of the brain. You know when you teach school kids? Because I was a school teacher. Part of learning how to be a school teacher in the UK was you had to do courses in educational psychology. And part of that was realizing you can only learn and do a certain amount of stuff in your brain before your brain just stops working. Or it just, you know, it's like you run out of your allocation on the internet, which happens all the time at our monastery. Don't know what the monks are up to, but every now and again when you run out of your allocation, the internet speed goes really down and it just really trickles. You know, you can't upload, download anything. Well, you can, but you have to wait for a long time. You know that experience? That's like your brain. When you run out of the quota in your brain, you can't do things. Ideas, they just trickle. You know, just typing a sentence takes almost forever because your brain is worn out. And I learned that in educational psychology, give kids a break in the morning, lunchtime, afternoon, it means that when they go back after the break, the brains are ready to learn. They've re-energized, they've rebooted. So this is really important. So that's why I always think that those tea breaks in the morning and in the afternoon, that was a cause of the rise of the British Empire. And as soon as they stopped doing that, of course it all went pear-shaped. So, I don't know, I've got all these theories, but there's something to that, having a little bit of rest and relaxation during the day when you really feel tired. And also, I go back to the university where I studied, Cambridge University, and I was doing physics, theoretical physics, and as part when you first went there, they took you around the Cavendish Laboratories in Cambridge. And these were really cool places because they took you around. See that little room over there? That was where J.J. Thomson invented the electron, or just not invented, it was already there, but discovered it. That room over there was where Rutherford split the atom. And this was history, but it was real. And all these scientists in those days, they were doing everything with just bits of paper and elastic bands. Their intuition, inventiveness was incredible. And they had these long corridors where they said, be careful, they're doing experiments on lasers. And everything was just really like going into some James Bond movie. You know, these little places, and you didn't know what these mad scientists were up to. But the most important lab in the whole of the Cavendish Laboratory, and I'm not exaggerating here, were the tea rooms. And it was obligatory that every person working in that lab had to go for morning and afternoon tea. You had to, no argument. Because in these big tea rooms, the tables were made out of this Laminex, and they were always having lots of felt tip pens on those tables. So when these scientists came in for morning tea or afternoon tea, they would continue their equations on the table. And their friends would be there, and their colleagues, and they could ask questions, get new ideas. And so many Nobel Prizes were achieved in the tea rooms of Cavendish Laboratory. Because if you're just by yourself, your mind goes into narrow directions, you can't see anything else, you're not creative because you're tired, but coming together, chatting over a cup of tea, and having the pens there to write down your equations, that was where the great discoveries were made, when you relax and do nothing. And I always thought, as soon as I heard that and saw that for myself, I looked at the old ladies who would serve tea and just give them the little buns in the afternoon. And I wondered whether they were KGB. And as soon as the scientists had finished photographing the tables, to send home to quite likely be a great place to put a spy in the tea rooms. Anyway, that was just my inventive imagination. But going back to the idea of when there's a time to rest, even when you're working. And if we don't do that, we get tired out. I gave a talk to this in Bangkok, Institution of Directors, all these big directors, you know, in Bangkok, all sorts of companies. I gave a talk to them, and I mentioned this, and they really took it on board. I mentioned one of the stories, and there's a couple of directors say, I'm going to go back, that's the most interesting story, I'm going to go back and implement this. And that was the story of, someone sent me this years ago, about a company in UK who won a prize for best business practice in that year. And I still remember the name, called Farrelly and Sons. It was an engineering company. And in 1 year, they trebled turnover, doubled profits. I've told this to a few business people. They said, well, that's a concern. If you treble turnover and only double the profits, you know, maybe you're just underselling things. But that's still pretty good. And they did this on the simplest of new strategies. they banned all overtime. No one was allowed to work beyond their allotted time, nor were they allowed to take work home with them. They finish work, go home to your families, relax. Because that little strategy meant when they went back to their families, their kids saw them, wives, husbands saw them, they had really rich family life and they could relax. So when they had a good sleep at night, instead of just working all hours, you know, finishing off some project or some contract or something, had a good evening with their family, they went to work the next morning, they were fresh. So they worked really well. Yes, they did not spend as much time in the office, but the time they spent there was far more productive. Can you imagine what happens? You know, you may unfortunately have experienced this, had an argument with your wife or your husband, the kids are in trouble at school, and you go to work the next day and that's preying on your mind. You can't focus on your job which you're being paid for. You're worried about the family life. And that's not going to be very good for the company. But imagine, great family life, could spend time with them. You go to work, mind focused, fresh, energized, you do really well. So productivity went up, even though they weren't spending so many hours at the office. And number two, staff turnover went down to zero. No one wanted to leave a company like that. And of course, any of you working in any part of the business or the companies which employ you, you know if somebody leaves, it takes such a long time to replace them, to train them up, to get them to know the job, know the people, know the way the company or the organization works. To train new people takes a lot of time. And all that time, the company is suffering. To keep personnel is really, really important. That's why I always tell Ajahn Brahmani, you don't have to give so many talks. You can go back and have a nice rest at night. He's key personnel. I'm always a bit worried when he goes to Singapore that they might poach him. But he goes to Norway a lot, and I try to figure out ways they don't build a monastery over there, otherwise I've lost him. But they've got somebody else there anyway, so that's good. So replacing key personnel is really difficult. So that way, the whole company did much better. Simple things like that. They knew when it's a time to work, work. And they did that. When it's a time to let go and relax with your family, they knew how to do that. It was encouraging that, which is a great balance of life. Now, it's also that sometimes the thing is, we don't know how to do that sometimes. We don't know how to relax. Even your own home. It's a weekend. Many of you aren't working. You've finished work for the week. Some of you are working, like me. But when it's time for you to have some time off, how many of you can enjoy your weekend? Or how many have already got your list of things you have to do this weekend? You've got such a big list, you can't wait to get back to work on Monday to relax. What the heck are you doing? Can't you learn how to have a nice weekend? What's really important? Getting all the things done and getting all these jobs out of the way? What are you actually getting done? You are getting done, done over. What are you getting out of the way? You're getting life out of the way. That's what you're doing. You're not enjoying, happy, you're not resting. So for goodness sake, this weekend, have at least a couple of hours of doing nothing. Put that on the top of your list. Do nothing. And get that out of the way first. And then you can do all the other stuff. You need some rest and relaxation. And it's because people don't know how to rest and relax these days. It's incredible. You have a day off. You have a couple of hours off. What do? What's on the TV? What's on the internet? What's in the fridge? I'm bored. How can you be bored? You've got an hour or two just by yourself. Enjoy doing nothing. But you're so addicted to doing things. It's like taking that off you. It's just so difficult. So here you can learn how to do nothing. Of course, you know, on this meditation, some people teach meditation, and it's just another work to be done. Watch your breath, sit still, do this, get that. It's just like, you know, going to military camp again. You know, go to school again. You know the way I teach meditation here? Just relax, let go, leave it alone. I'm teaching you how to let things be. And it's such a hard thing for people to do. But people get it after a while. And when you do learn how to relax and let things be, give yourself time and stop doing stuff for at least half an hour. You find your life becomes far more successful. Your health improves. Your whole quality of life gets better because you're relaxing. You know how to sleep at night. You know how to sit in your chair or in the garden and just, as I say, this weekend, sit in your garden or go to King's Park or somewhere where there's some trees, sit down and watch the trees grow. Because, you know, sometimes people ask that. Your wife comes out and says, "Darling, what are you doing?" If you say you're doing nothing, "Oh, you can come and help me then." That's terrible. So, don't say you're doing nothing. Go out there and say, "I'm watching the trees grow." Okay? Don't interrupt me, because they're growing, but you've got to really watch. And you, otherwise you miss it. It takes at least a couple of hours to watch a tree grow. Now this is skillful means, so you can have some peace of mind. And when it's time to do something, give it everything you've got. This was Ajahn Chah's teaching, because this guy came up to me, "I'll put this in Opening the Door of Your Heart number one." And it was a guy came up, he lived in Sydney, came to see me in Perth. And no one else knows his story except him, because it's a personal story which changed his life. He told it to me, I share it with other people. When the great Ajahn Chah in Thailand started to become famous, this guy in Sydney heard this, and he wanted to ask a real wise person these important questions he had in life. And so he travelled all the way from Sydney to Thailand, not to go to any hotel or resort, just to see Ajahn Chah, ask the questions and come back home again. A very busy man, big family. So he finally found the way to the northeast of Thailand, which is quite remote, and find where this monk lived, find in the monastery where his hut was, and he succeeded. He saw this great monk surrounded by about 200 people, all wanting to ask their questions. He waited and waited and waited, and he wasn't getting anywhere closer. If ever that happens to me, please, Buddhist Society, buy a machine. Take your number, and so I say, calling number 64, please come up to ask your question. Have you been to those places where they give you numbers and they have to wait until your number comes up? I did that about 2 months ago. I went to get my visa to go to Indonesia, and I was waiting. I got a ticket, and I was waiting there for 1 hour, and then I had to go for lunch, so never got my ticket. Answered. Anyway, I actually gave it to somebody else because I was ahead of them. I have my ticket. That's very nice. If you have these tickets, don't screw them up. Give them to somebody else. That's really nice. Anyway, what was I going on about? Asking questions. Yeah, he was surrounded, Ajahn Chah was surrounded by all these people. So this guy was waiting a couple of hours, 2.5 hours, getting no closer. So he gave up. Came all that way just for seeing the monk, and he realized there's no way he could see him. And so he was walking to his taxi to take him back to the airport, to go back to Bangkok, to fly back to Sydney, and he realized he had another hour to kill. And he saw the other monks were sweeping, doing some cleaning in the temple. Now remember, if you volunteer to do some cleaning in any temple, even this one, it's amazing the karmic, the good karma you get. Just washing up the dishes on a Friday evening, sweeping, tidying up the chairs. You wouldn't believe the amazing good karma you get by helping out the temple. So what he did, he saw them sweeping. He picked up a broom. He started sweeping too. He was sweeping only for 5 or 10 minutes. And he said he felt a hand on his shoulder. And when you feel someone behind you putting their hand on your shoulder, you turn around abruptly. And that hand was connected to an arm. And that arm was connected to Ajahn Chah. Wow! Now those of you who've lived with these monks, you know that they do have powers. They know what's going on. He realized this guy had come a long way and had to go home soon. So he was actually got up from his seat, even though the other people were waiting to talk to him, went up and wanted to give this guy a teaching. And the teaching was this, a one-liner which changed this guy's whole life. He said after this one-liner, he went back, his business really flourished, his family life was great, his meditation really soared, everything in life just got so much better from this one-line teaching. Ajahn Chah said, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. That's all. And then he went away. Now that is profound. If you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. Which meant, if you're going to go to bed at night and rest, give it everything you've got. 100% sleep. If you're working, 100% work. If you are eating your dinner, 100% eating dinner. Stop talking to the person sitting next to you. I often say this, people go out to these really expensive restaurants and you go and eating this food which costs a fortune with these great chefs. These chefs put so much effort and energy making beautiful food for you. And what do? You just shove it in your mouth while you're talking to the person sitting next to you. Would you do that if you went to the concert hall and say listen to Beethoven or something? While they're listening to Beethoven, the great concert, great symphony or something, you say, this is really good, coming to this hall. This hall is really good. The orchestra is really good. This is a very good symphony, and they're doing it very well. During the music, you'll get kicked out. They say, shut up, we're listening to the music. How can you have a conversation with the person sitting next to you, even if it's this beautiful girl you're taking out on a date for the first time, and listen to the music at the same time? But that's what you do in restaurants. Which means you can't enjoy the food. It's okay if you go to McDonald's or some cheap place. You can chat as much as you like. It takes your mind off the food. But if you go into a really nice restaurant, with your wife, and you pay all the money for this beautiful food, tell your wife to shut up until I'm finished eating. I'm really into romance. So if you're eating, give it everything you've got. If you're talking to someone, give that everything you've got. And you find a lot of times we never give things everything we've got. We're half here and half in the future somewhere. Or maybe that ratio is not right. Maybe 10% here, 60% in the future, 40%, 30% in the past. We're never really here, giving everything we've got to this moment. I just came from a very busy trip to Thailand and Singapore, teaching all day yesterday till really late, traveling today, should be really tired, but you can see I give everything I've got to these talks. Really full energy. And this guy understood this. And so when he went home, his life just blossomed. Simple thing. When it's time to let go, give letting go everything you've got. Try it. When it's time to work, give it everything you've got. When it's resting time, give it everything you've got. And of course, when you make a donation, give it everything. Oh, I almost got you. Never mind. I thought I'd slip that one through. Give it everything you've got. Anyway, and the other thing is that when we learn how to give everything we've got to what we're doing, we know the right time to let go, the right time to put forth effort, and then we understand this great story, which I can't improve on. It's again another story from Opening the Door of Your Heart. And because I mentioned this in Singapore, and so many people hadn't heard it before. I assume that you all heard these so many times before. But even if you have heard it before, it's great to retell this because they're profound, they're deep. You understand so much from this. And that was the guy who was a senior school teacher. He was the head of the English department in the school I taught for 1 year. And just one day in the staff room, he was just reminiscing about his time in as a British Army, Second World War. And he's only a young guy, 18 or something, and he got posted out to Burma. You know, Second World War, fighting the Japanese. And he was said, on one occasion, he was out on a patrol with about five other soldiers. His captain and the scout were two of those. And just an ordinary patrol, and the scout came back and told them the terrible news. They've just wandered into this huge number of Japanese troops by mistake, and now they were totally surrounded and vastly outnumbered. This was war. This was serious business. And so many thousands of miles away from home, he thought this meant death, certain death. But people in the army tell me that no one knows who will be the hero and who will be the coward. Sometimes these tough guys, they lose it. And sometimes these little weedy, weak guys become the heroes. And he decided to be the hero. Let's fight our way through. Who knows? One of us might make it. At least we'll try. And if we die, we die serving our country, being proud soldiers and taking many of the enemy with us into death. That's the right thing to do. God save the king. The king in those days. So, he said, let's fight. The captain said, no, we will not fight the enemy. Instead, I order everyone to sit down and make a cup of tea. It was the British Army, after all. And this actually happened. In the middle of the jungle in Burma during the Second World War, surrounded by the enemy, vastly outnumbered, about to die, they had a cup of tea. I told you the brilliance of tea. So, what happened next? He thought this was the craziest order he'd ever had to follow. He thought, I'm about to die. How can you think of having a cup of tea? But orders were orders. He had to do it. Thinking, crazy, ridiculous. And before they finished the tea, the scout, who didn't have his tea, he was scouting around, and he said, put your things away quickly. The enemy has moved. There's a way through. And of course, that's what they did. Everyone survived without a scratch. That's why he could tell me the story. And he said, that captain's wisdom saved his life. And he said, actually, a couple of other times, too. He once had cancer. No hope. Surrounded by the enemy, about to die. You know what he did? Relaxed and had a cup of tea. Another time, he was almost in financial ruin. What did he do? Relax and have a cup of tea. When there's nothing to do, give doing nothing everything you've got. And if you don't know how to do nothing and relax, if you haven't learned that, then when the time is obviously to do nothing, you don't know how to do it. You think, I'm going to fight. If they'd have fought, they'd have all been dead. It was a useless option. Instead, wait. Because life is always changing. Things alter. New opportunities come. I don't know what happens, but treatments or opportunities, things you haven't thought of before, the enemy keeps moving. And when you see your chance, where you can be effective, then you give that everything you've got. He crawled through the enemy just so mindfully, so carefully, that everyone escaped. When there's something to do, give it everything you've got. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. have a cup of tea. If you don't like tea, a cup of coffee if you like. Peppermint tea, orange juice. Infant Asia, I say just get a bowl of noodles. Because they eat noodles all day. Breakfast noodles, lunch noodles. Ugh, noodle out when you go to Asia. But anyway, that's okay. That's what you like. So that's good enough. So when there's things to do, everything you've got. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. Now that is the difference between attachment, letting go, knowing the time. And of course, I've seen for so often in life, the thing which people don't know how to do, even though they know it's the time to do it, is letting go. Someone is close to death. You can't keep them alive. Let it go. The past. It's unchangeable. Let it go. The future, you don't know what's happening. In the present moment, you give everything you've got to the present moment. Then you'll be highly successful. Meditation, great. Life, brilliant. And really happy. So simple. So that's the difference. Attachment, letting go, knowing the time to be attached, knowing the time to let go, and being skilled in both areas. A balanced human being. Not someone who just keeps doing stuff all their life, but someone who can stop and enjoy the life in the gaps and spaces when they're not doing things. That is wisdom. Now, I'm going to stop, because I know when it's a time to stop. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, we got some questions now. See where they're coming from today. We have one. Oh, one from Norway. Ajahn Brahmali. They must know you here. From Brazil and from UK. Those are the three countries today. Firstly, we've got Ajahn Brahmali's friend who's come over to see him. So that's why Ajahn Brahmali's up today. If you want to commit by becoming an anagarika, that means starting your monastic life, how should you deal with the dilemma of having a partner you already share a normal life with? Normal? What do you mean normal life with a partner? If life with a partner was normal, you wouldn't be bothering me with all these questions about marriage and falling in love with somebody else and arguing with your wife and should we do this and should we do that? Anyway, just that's common anyway. So you want to leave the world, but you have a partner you already share a life with. Now, there's something about that commitment. If you've got a partner and a kid, if you're committed to them because you've got married, you all know the difference between involvement and commitment. If you're just going out with somebody, you're just involved. Even engaged, they're still just involved. But once you have those wedding rings on, that's called commitment. You made a commitment to someone, you should keep that commitment. And if you want to know the difference between involvement and commitment, where's Dennis? Because I say this to all the marriages. The difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. Think about it. Bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, the chicken is involved, but the pig committed. You've got it, thank you. So if you're committed with your partner, then forget about being an anagarika. If you're involved, okay. So, but there comes a time with a partner, and I've seen this with many people, the partners, they know that their partner, you know, wants to sort of join a spiritual life. And sometimes you do it with your partner's blessing. Because in a real relationship, is, you know, you want the other person to be happy. You know, your happiness as well, but you realize that this is what they really need to do, that's who they are. And it's not running away from you. They still love you, but this is, you know, they're almost their destiny, their fate, they want to do this. A lot of time the wife or the husband just says, yeah, I know this is what you are. And they give you full permission. When that happens, it's wonderful. When that happens, you see, you know, the wife coming to the ordination ceremony, they offer robes to their husband, and they do it with joy. Think, you know, you're really happy, wonderful. Or they're the other way around, when the husband comes and gives the robes to the wife, as they happened here with one of the bhikkhunis or samaneris. I think it was Anya. I think her husband came and offered the robes to Anya, if I remember was right. That was beautiful. It said, look, we lived together for a long time. Now you're going to another period of your life. I've loved you. I want to support you in this part of your next life. That's beautiful when that happens. So if that happens, beautiful. But make sure, if it really is committed to a partner, really committed, then you make sure you go with her approval, or his approval. Second question, is it possible to know for sure when we let go of the past and future, we're not just repressing some unpleasant feeling that will come out later? If it's repressing it, it's done through force. Letting it go. I'm not going to listen to that. It's so disgusting what happened to me. It's just so rotten what I had to experience. That's repression. And you may have noticed when I taught meditation in the beginning, I didn't say push away the past. I say relax, and then the past vanishes. That is not repression. That is something much more important. It is a letting go of the past, not pushing it away. And because it's true, if you push things away, they keep resurfacing. In fact, if you push them away, you give them more importance and they grow. They become more of a problem. The more you push them away, the bigger they become. But the way I'm saying here, relaxing, is something, you know, this guy who wrote this question here, he said, oh, all these people with troubles, they all get their solved, not by Buddhism, but by psychology. My goodness, if you look at psychology these days, it's all Buddhist. Honestly, I told the story when I was in Kuala Lumpur, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. This incredibly wealthy businessman, you know, he came up to me and he said he'd just been to the Mayo Clinic in Cleveland, where all the film stars and pop stars, you know, go. It costs a fortune to go to that clinic for therapy. He had depression, anxiety, I forget what it was, some addiction. And he went to this place. Cost him an absolute fortune. He had actually, because he had money, he had a personal interview with Jon Kabat-Zinn, the guy who founded the mindfulness movement. And when he came back, he said, Ajahn Brahm, all these guys here, they're all Buddhists, every one of them. And he said, they teach the same thing as you do, only not as clear. And he said, I'm crazy. I spent all this money going to the United States, and I can hear better from you. He said, yeah, I teach these guys. You go to the source. And it's really cheap when you come here. Honestly, that a lot of the stuff which comes from psychology, you know, comes here, from here, and you hear it first. There's a few psychologists here, come every week, just to refresh. And I remember this one psychologist, she came in here, she was working with trauma victims, and she said, honestly, Ajahn Brahm, I got my permission to actually to teach and to become a professional psychologist therapist by going to university. I had to do that. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the certificates and permission. But she said, everything which is practical, everything which I use every day, I heard here in Dhammaloka, not at university, but right here. So should we teach this? So, and repressing, pushing things away is repressing. Opening the door of your heart, bringing it in, is called letting go. That's powerful, it works. So you don't repress the past, you let it go. Let it come, let it be, and then it goes. It's not important anymore. Every time you hide it, you bury it under the ground, it grows up again. You bring it into the heart. The old story, you've heard this here, one of my favorite stories, going home, treading in the dog shit, getting all over your shoes. Psychologists would say, scrape it off. It's disgusting. Ajahn Brahm says, take it home with you. Don't repress it. Embrace it. Embrace the dog shit of life. But you take it home with you and you take it into your garden. and you scrape it off under your mango tree. And 1 year later, your mangoes are sweeter and juicier than ever before. You've never known such sweet and juicy mangoes. But you must always remember when you bite into that mango, and as I usually say, the juice starts trickling down your cheek. Oh, it's so delicious. You must always remember what you are really eating. You're eating dog shit. Honestly, that's where it came from. But it's been transformed into beautiful manga. That is what psychologists use. Now you know how to not repress the past, but to turn it into juicy manga. And how do you make decisions without being judgmental? You just make decisions and you don't judge good or bad. I'm not going to say it now, but the book is available in the library. Good, bad, who knows? You make a decision, you don't know what's going to happen. You can't predict the future. If I make this decision, this might happen. If I make another decision, something else might happen. It's confusing. And you can't predict the future, so how do you know which decision to make? Choosing a political party, choosing where to invest your money, choosing what to talk about tonight, choosing who to marry. You have all these decisions in life. It doesn't matter. Just marry someone. Honestly, girls are all the same. I keep on saying this. I've known a lot of girls. I've got a much better objective view than you guys have. Yes, it is true. They have a different chassis, but the engine is exactly the same. That's wise, it's true, you know. Guys, they're the same as well. And don't think you've got a faulty model. They're all faulty, and there's no way of having them recalled. That's what they do with cars. So, what I do, make the decision, and then make it work. Trouble is, we make decisions, and we want, which is the right one, which is the wrong one. No decisions are right, no decisions are wrong. It's what we do afterwards makes them right or wrong. So you make it, you married someone. Make it work. It's not a wrong decision. It's what you do after marriage makes it a happy marriage or a bad marriage. You start a business. It's what you do afterwards with that business makes it successful or not successful. The decision itself is not important. It's what you do afterwards is. That's why it's very easy for me to make decisions. Just make it. I don't care. Turn left, turn right, doesn't matter. It's what I do after I turn right and how I proceed on that journey. That is the important part of life. So there we go. How do you make decisions without being judgmental? Just make them. And then work hard to make them work. Okay, there we go. So that's it, folks. Any questions from the floor? Going. Yeah, gone. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then you can go home, I can go to bed as soon as you let me after all these people come up and chat to me. I've had a long day.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sanghang Namami.